Welcome to Great Minds, and our guest today is an old and dear friend, a true legend of the business. He is one of the smartest, most creative people our industry has ever seen. Is in Atlanta now, a place I'm very fond of. Bob, I think you know I went to Emory way back when.
Absolutely.
And with us today is the great Bob Hope, chairman of Hope Beckham Espinosa, but really one of the most brilliant creative minds, proud alumni of Georgia State University, another great school, and thrilled to have you here with us, Bob.
Well, it's great to be here, and I'm really happy to do this.
It's great. Well, I guess as someone wise once said, it's great to be anywhere, right?
Well, you know what? That's true. However, we got to make the most of while we're around, so.
There you go. So, Bob, there are so many places to start with you, but I can't help but go back to your days working in PR for the Atlanta Braves and Ted Turner and Hank Aaron and so many great, great stories, really where you cut your teeth working for Ted, a name that is not quite lost in history, but is not nearly as prominent as I would argue it should be as an innovator, as somebody who was a first to so many firsts that really reshaped the industry in so many ways. But could we dial the clock back? Geez, got to be 50 plus years to those early days working with the Braves and Ted Turner and when Hank broke Babe Ruth's home run record and all those great, great stories from those early days of, let's call it a young Bob Hope.
That's right. Well, it definitely was a young Bob Hope. I was blessed. I needed a job when I was working my way through college. I mean, just to pay for it. And I worked all night in a packaging plant for like a month. And I thought, I just can't do this. So I thought, made a list of places that seemed like they'd be fun to work. And I just showed up on a Saturday morning at the Braves at the stadium. And the Braves at that time were new to Atlanta. And they had actually operated out of trailers outside the stadium. And I walked around, found the only person who was there on Saturday morning in a trailer was their head of operations named Jim Hay. And I just went in and said, look, I've got to work my way through college. I've been working all night in a packaging plant. I said, I just can't do this. I'm looking for a job I'd enjoy and want to see if you have one. And as things would have it, the Braves hired me. First of all, they hired me to just do whatever in the office. And then fairly quickly after that, the assistant PR director had to go into the Army. And so they called me in and asked me if I knew what a press release was, could write a press release. And I said, absolutely, knowing if I said no, that I, the interview was over. Well, I had no idea what a press release was. And then they asked me if I could do baseball statistics. So they hired me to be the assistant public relations director when I was like 19 years old, working part-time through college. And I just sort of hung in there and stayed. And, just being in the right place at the right time is one of the most miraculous things that can happen in life because I started so early, I became the head of public relations and promotions for the Braves when I was 24. And then I was in charge of the Major League Baseball All-Star game at age 25, things you could never do today. And then we immediately went into the home run chase with Hank Aaron. So we're traveling around the country. As you remember, that home run chase was happening during the civil rights movement. So the attention it got was not just as a sports event. It was, it was a sports record being sought, but also, historic from a civil rights standpoint, historic, in society. So we had 400 media people traveling with us for about 2 years. And so, that was a blessing. In fact, Hank and I remained very close friends for his entire lifetime. When he died, there were only two non-family pallbearers at his funeral, me and Dusty Baker. So we're, that's what a blessing that is, just to know someone like that. And then after Hank broke the home run record, this guy that I'd worked with in television some, because he televised the Braves, and so I knew him reasonably well, but I thought, oh my God, I couldn't imagine why anybody would ever go to work for him. He bought the Braves. It was Ted Turner. And he called me in and he said, you know every media person in the country because you've been traveling with them on the road for 2 years. Make me famous. So for the next few years, we just did whatever crazy thing we could. We'd have dinner one night. I always tell people it's really interesting in this day where you have strategy sessions and brainstorming, then you check things out really thoroughly. Ted and I had dinner one night, and it was right after he had gone through the renewal process with the FCC for Channel 17, which at that time was WTCG, became WTBS. And he hated the FCC because they'd send these young guys in, they'd sit them down, they'd grill him, and Ted was not particularly fond of that process. And if you recall, at the time, his news, the FCC required you to run news. Well, he thought news made people feel bad. So we had Bill Tush at 3 a.m. Our newscast was at 3 a.m. in the morning. And so news wasn't something he was particularly fond of. But Ted, after he had met with the FCC and had behaved and gone well, we're at dinner. And he said, and Jerry Hogan was there with us. And I think you may remember Jerry. There were three of us. And Ted said, we don't need a broadcast signal. He said, we have whatever it was back then, 5 million people watching on cable, our Braves. We can just go straight to cable. And Jerry said, you could, but if you did that, you'd lose all your advertisers. And he said, well, we could start an all cable network. And nobody had done that yet. It was, just a non-existent idea. And so we thought, we were sitting there just brainstorming, said, well, if we did one, what we could do, what would we do? And it was interesting, the thought process we went through. First one was, well, what if we did all sports? And Ted said, no, they're just not enough sports. You could never have an all sports network. This was before CNN. And then I was the stupid one that said, well, how about music? Music's on, nobody's going to watch music on TV. And that was before MTV. And then WGST Radio in Atlanta had just become Atlanta's first all news radio station. And their theme was tune in, tune out, news whenever you want it. And so I said, well, why don't we do news? We could do 24-hour news. We're just chatting. And Ted said, no, news makes people feel bad. Besides, nobody's going to sit down for 3 hours at night and watch the news. I said, oh, no, Ted, you don't get it. It's tune in, tune out. News whenever you want. It's the 6 o'clock news. You can watch it anytime. So he sat there, thought for a second. He said, news, news, news. Let's do news. And he jumped up, and that was it. And then suddenly he was Mr. News. We're out there. I think it was like 3 weeks later at a Hawks game. Walter Cronkite was at the game with him. He really got in, as Ted would, just with a great passion pursuing the idea of starting CNN.
Amazing. And let's go back to something you said earlier, the opportunities you had as a 23, 24, 25-year-old were right place at the right time, really before the business was what it became. It was less important, I think you could say, and that was a little easier for a young person to get an opportunity. Similarly, when I was 23, I was made the first executive director of the Sports Commission. Here in New York, off what I learned interning for Jerry Bartles and Lee Ayers and the folks at Bob Eskew at the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce with their effort to wrap Atlanta around a sports economic development future, which worked brilliantly. Talk about that experience as a young guy. You don't know what the hell you're doing, but you're going out and getting stuff done, and you figure out how you did it after it was done versus developing a plan and a strategy and all those things that are such a part of today. This was, a non-McKinsey way of doing things.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. There's a saying. In fact, I was in New York for years, and we used to laugh and say that a strategic plan was what people spend meetings and meetings and meetings to pull together, write it up, then put it in the bottom drawer and forget about it. And you just take off and do what you're supposed to do. One of the things I learned fairly quickly, I mean, I didn't really realize it until, hindsight, was that young people often can do things far better than older people because they're not restricted by tradition. Like when I ran the Major League Baseball All-Star game, I had read about the Super Bowl and all the parties they had, and read about how they had transportation committees at golf tournaments, and they pick up people at the airport, how they decorate the city. Well, baseball had never done that. The only All-Star game I'd been to was the year before we hosted it, and that was in Detroit. And I think as a young person, I was kind of thought, well, my gosh, they don't really decorate the city. The only decoration of the stadium was bunting they had. And then their hospitality was basically non-existent. It was for men only, and it was a continental breakfast and, very little to it. So I had all these grand plans. So I thought, we'd have lavish hospitality. So I went to, you're talking about the Jerry Bartles and the chamber. This was actually before Jerry, the previous head of the chamber, and I can't remember his name right now. But I went to him, and I wanted to decorate the city, and I wanted to have lavish hospitality, but I didn't have any money, so I'd made up a budget, and I went to him to find out if he could help me raise some money. And I should remember his name, because he sat down and he said, "Well, let me, you got your budget there?" And I did. And I said, "I don't think we can do all this and all, but I just, budgeted out." And the total was $600,000. And he said, "Wait a minute." He gets on the phone, and this is Atlanta back then, or just smaller town. Is he gets on the phone and he calls the, Luke Smith, who was the president of the Coca-Cola company at the time. Then he called the, head of the, CEO of Delta Airlines, and he called the head of Georgia Power, and he called the head of Atlanta Gas Light, and he got $150,000 committed from each of them. So I'm in there for a 45-minute meeting, and I walk out with $600,000. But then what we found out is one of the greatest barriers sometimes for progress is just sheer tradition. I went out and I thought, well, the reason that they only had continental breakfast and only had men only in baseball was because they couldn't afford, to have women and have, and so I get there and I have this lavish hospitality set up at the Marriott Hotel and have an orchestra playing and all. And the All-Star game's on Tuesday night, but all the teams come in and officials on Sunday and stay over the next 3 or 4 days. And that Sunday night, I have my hospitality all set up and big in the banquet room and a giant buffet, and it just looked wonderful. And I was so excited. And actually, my wife Susan was the first one who went down, first woman that tried to enter. Well, Major League Baseball had hired the security. And so as she's walking in, they said, "Ma'am, this is for men only." And so Susan starts walking away. Well, Bill Lucas, who you knew, was the first African American general manager. He was our farm director back then. And Bill sees Susan walking away. He said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Well, they don't allow women in there." And Bill took her by the arm, walked up to the security guard, and said, "They used to treat my people this way too." And then they walked in. Well, word got out, and suddenly all the women are down there, and it just became a party. And the next 3 or 4 days, everybody was having a great time. But I didn't know that women weren't supposed to be allowed. And then we did things back then that, we allowed broadcasters in the press box, and people were just going, the New York baseball writers are going nuts. You don't allow broadcasters in the press box. Well, I didn't know. I mean, it just seemed like a lo logical thing. But then the most embarrassing moment was that when I was in Detroit, it just seemed like the field looked kind of barren. And so, the NFL used to paint these giant logos in the middle of the field, and all still do. And so I called the Falcons to find out, how do you get the logo painted? And they said, "Well, there's a guy in New Orleans who makes stencils. And so you just call him up and tell him, what you want, and send him the design. He'll make you a stencil." So I call this guy up, and we had an All-Star logo. And I said, "I want to put a lo logo in center field for the All-Star game." And he said, "Really?" He said, "Well, send it to me." Then we're talking on the phone, and he said, "How big do you want it?" And I said, "How big can you make it?" And he said, "Well, I make these stencils in a high school gym." And I said, "I want it as big as a high school gym." And so we have this giant logo, and our ground crew goes out and they paint it in center field. And then it was their idea. They get up in the upper deck and they look at it and think, it looks fairly lonely out there. It looks nice. And so why don't we paint the coaches' boxes and paint the on-deck circles and paint the tops of the dugout? So we had an artist design all that. We painted up. And I thought, boy, this is so glorious. People are going to be so excited. And then right before the game, the umpires called me down and they said, "We can't play the game." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "This is all against the ground rules of baseball. You can't paint the field like that." And so luckily, I was in a panic. I didn't know what to do. Luckily, Bowie Kuhn was the commissioner back then. And Bowie, I love Bowie Kuhn. He came down and talked to the umpires, and he said, "Get me a rule book." And so he's looking at the rule book, and he said, "You know, this is an exhibition game. We can do whatever we want to." And walked away. I said, "Thank you, Bowie Kuhn." So you just, I think my point is simply that, if you go into stuff with an open mind and you want to do a really good job, young people sometimes aren't restricted by the barriers that older people have just because that's the way it's always been done.
Right, being a little naive and having a little good old-fashioned moxie can get you a long way.
In fact, Hank Aaron told me one time he was talking to Ted years later, and he said, "You know what, Bob Hope was really creative." And Ted looked at him and said, "Well, there are a lot of creative people. Bob Hope was fearless and creative." And I think sometimes you got to be a little fearless too.
You sure were. And Bob, we can't have you on and not ask a little bit about that home run tour with Hank around the press. It was a bigger moment in culture and civil rights movement as a backdrop, but that had to leave some indelible memories for you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is all very logical, but I don't know that we necessarily think about it. Is very seldom in any sport do you have that many, the World Series, you have 400 media come in. However, they're covering two teams. In this case, we had 400 media covering one person. And this one person was under intense, scrutiny. I mean, under it, there was nothing he could do that wasn't really covered by the media, both good and bad. But Hank was, if you had to pick someone to do it, you couldn't pick anybody any nicer, any more thoughtful, any more humble. I mean, Hank was wonderful all the way through the process. There's no question. You get a lot of attention is given to the hate mail that he got. It received, and he did receive a good bit. I mean, he received some, but he also, in number, it was dwarfed by the bags and bags of just fan mail from baseball fans that were wishing him well. Back then, as you said, it wasn't quite so sophisticated as today. He couldn't do this, but lots of people would send baseballs for him to sign. We couldn't sign all those baseballs. So Carla Copeland, who was his secretary, who answered the mail and did all that, she and I would sit up there and see who could sign the best Hank Aaron, then send the balls back. So there are thousands of Hank Aaron autographed baseballs out there signed by me and Carla. But it was an intense time, but it was an enjoyable time for me because of Hank. I mean, I was a young guy. I mean, I didn't, whatever he needed, I was just trying to accommodate, under a good bit of stress because of the pure number of media that were coming in, but had terrific cooperation from all the teams in baseball. We put together a Hank Aaron press guide, and we had a procedure of pregame interviews and then, pregame press conference, postgame press conference that we put in place, sent it to all the teams. They all adhered to it. Hank was gracious all the way. Funny things happened, like the way we set it up is we would segment interviews like 20 minutes at a time during the day before the game, and then we'd have a big press conference. But the top media would get their 20 minutes if they asked for it early enough. We showed up in LA at the Dodgers, and a group of about 20 Japanese writers had shown up unannounced. And so we sit down and say, "Well, we got to give them some time before the game." So we carve out somehow about 20 minutes for them to interview them. And then I'm sitting in the dugout, and Hank comes to him and he said, "Bob," he said, "they have more questions they want to ask me, and I don't really have time. I've got these other interviews." I told him that you've heard the answer, every answer I've ever given to any question. They want to interview you as if you're me. So I'm sitting there with the translator, and I'm just, answering questions. I thought about 5 minutes into it, I am like Hank Aaron. This is great. I know every answer. Just, that would never happen today, but things like that were really colorful. I mean, Hank was always very nice. I mean, he'd worry about me. I'd come in, I'd be frazzled, and he'd to the clubhouse, and he'd say, "Sit down. How you doing?" And I said, "I'm a little, tense now. I'm sort of over. I'm really tired." And he said, "Bob, it's just baseball. Relax. It's okay. It's going to be good." And then I'd walk out, and like, well, he's the one that's going through this. I'm just kind of tagging along.
Oh, great, great stuff, Bob. And let's go back to Ted Turner for a minute again. Not every day we get to have a conversation about another icon in a different way. And when you look today at, what Warner Brothers Discovery is really struggling to do, with those assets and how the business has changed so much. Often I feel like Ted doesn't get the credit he deserved. I was a huge fan of his. As you recall, we had written the bid that won the Goodwill Games for New York for 1998 and very involved in the 94 games in St. Petersburg, Russia. And Ted was there in full force as he singularly bridged the Olympic boycotts when, as you recall, the U.S. And the Soviets had not competed against each other for 10 years. Going back to the 76 Montreal Games, the Soviets had boycotted the LA Games, ironically protesting the U.S. protesting their invasion of Afghanistan. And then in 84, they paid us back and didn't come to the LA Games, 80 rather, in Moscow. We boycotted them. Talk about Ted and the vision that he had. He was so ahead of his time in so many ways.
Yeah, Ted, it's interesting. Once again, I'll go back to sometimes you're better off being young than you would be older because older people sometimes are cynical. When Ted came in, I knew he was, he just was, he put on his act, like he was, ranting and raving and he'd, wave his arms and he'd start singing, You Gotta Have Heart out of nowhere and just go through the whole thing. That was just his personality. And a lot of, folks would say, oh my gosh, this guy's crazy. How do you work for him? Well, working for him for me was somewhat of a joy because there was never a moment I could come up with the stupidest idea you can even imagine. And Ted would just think it was brilliant. And Ted, you just had this great feeling of this person who had in boundless aspirations to do great things with his life. He used to say he was Alexander the Great, and he was going to take over the world through communication. And he just had this great bravado that you'd get caught up in. And as somebody to work for, I mean, there was a lot of pressure because his expectation level was so high, but you never at any moment felt like he didn't totally believe you and totally trust you. So I enjoyed working for him. He was willing to do anything, and he just had a magical personality. Years later, I interviewed him on stage at the Atlanta Rotary Club, and I'm up there and the president of the club. I told Ted we're going to leave time at the end for questions from the audience, and the president of the club, as we were walking up on stage, said, "Bob, we can't have Q&A because somebody's going to bring up Jane Fonda in North Korea. So just, don't do the Q&A." Well, I already told Ted we were going to do it. So I figured as we got close to the end, he was going to say, let's do some, get some questions from the audience. And so I'm trying to think of what to do. And so, and you'd never do this with anybody else, but when you deal with Ted, it just seemed like the natural thing to do. I said, Ted, I said, this has been a lot of fun. He's, oh, yeah, this has been a lot of fun. But I said, this club has the best speakers in the world come in. So depending on what we do right now, they're either going to forget us in 2 weeks or they're going to remember us for a long time. And he said, well, what do you think I ought to do? And I said, well, Ted, I want you to get up there and sing. And he said, you want me to sing? I said, yeah. He said, what do you want me to sing? I said, what do you know? And he said, well, I know all three verses of My Old Kentucky Home. And I said, go for it. And he gets up there and he belts it out and he sings, think it was Carnegie Hall or something. And then, he gets a standing ovation to this moment. Ted doesn't realize we didn't have Q&A. Just Ted did. At one time during the talk, I took a baseball out of my pocket and I put it on the ground. I said, Ted, I said, years and years ago, I said, I had this idea that may not have been such a great idea. This was a long time ago, during the 76 Olympics, we were going to have a baseball Olympics before the game between the Braves and the Phillies. And different things you could do with the baseball. And one of them, I was going to have a Braves player race from third base against a Phillies player from first base, pushing the baseball with their nose to home plate. And the one that got there first would be the winner. And I said, Tug McGraw from the Phillies was willing to do it. But all the Braves players said, "Bob, this hurts our nose. The baseball's gritty, and we'll do anything for you. We can't do this." So rather than say, "Let's not do that event," I thought, "What do you do?" Well, I think this makes a statement, I guess, of Ted. I thought, "Well, I'll do what seems to be the most obvious thing." So I sent someone to the stadium club to get Ted, who was having dinner with Jesse Jackson that night, and tell Ted I need him right now. Ted comes running down, and he said, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "Go put on your uniform." He had his own baseball uniform. He comes out, and I said, "Ted, I want you to get at third base, get on your hands and knees, push the baseball with your nose, and race Tug McGraw to see who gets to home plate first." Well, Ted jumped in and did it, and he bloodied his nose, and he won the thing. And so I put the baseball down at the Rotary meeting. I said, "Ted, I've always wondered, why did you do that?" And he said, "Because you told me to." And I thought that was sort of the way it was. Ted was just willing to do anything all those years. And it just, if one thing didn't work, it didn't faze him, we'd go on to the next one. Sometimes he'd sit down, a little bit, bipolar, and he, with his down moments, he said, "Think about it. I failed at almost everything I've ever done." And he'd go through all his failures. I said, "Ted, but look how successful you are." And he said, "Well, I came up with a superstation." And he said, "And that sort of covered all sins." I said, "That's right. Most people don't have something to cover all sins."
Yeah, no, incredible stories. And I guess he started way back when, it's forgotten, but wasn't he just in the outdoor billboard business?
Yeah, he was in the outdoor billboard business. But he started a lot of things. He had a Pepsi Cola bottling plant, or, two radio stations, a shipbuilding business. He had some things that didn't work out so well, but he was able to take the concept of putting a UHF TV signal up on satellite and distributed across the country to cable systems and really make that into essentially a network. And that the WG, I mean, it just became a lot, the ESPNs of the world, the M, MTVs, all of these other entities that did similar things followed him.
Yeah, no, they did follow him. And Bob, at some point you make a transition, and where we first really got to know each other was when you were working for two of the great PR firms, Cohn and Wolf, and then Burson Marsteller. How did you go that evolution? Give us that sort of origin story of how you ended up, in the high councils of power in the agency world.
Well, one of the, Ted, since I was his youngest direct report, I think he had five people that reported to him, and I was the youngest. You tend to call your youngest in and give them advice. You want to be their mentor. And Ted, would give me advice sometimes, always good advice. But one of them is, don't get caught up in your job titles, how much money you make. He said, there'll always be somebody making more money. You'll just frustrate yourself. He said, just follow your passion. And make sure that at the end of your life, you've done things that really were exciting to you. And so I worked for him for all those, for all those years, but you can only report to Ted for so long before physically it's, and it just takes up all your time. You're working from 7 in the morning till midnight almost every night. So I decided that if I was going to keep my family, Bill Lucas had a stroke at 42. I mean, the other people that reported to him were having physical problems. So I decided that I needed to do something else to stabilize my life because I had two little girls and wanted to keep my family together. And so I thought, what's the most stable place you can work on earth? And I thought the Coca-Cola Company, and Coca-Cola really wanted me to come in. I thought, Ted used to tell me I had the magic touch, and I thought, boy, Coca-Cola will be so excited to have the magic touch. And I get into this, sort of, I mean, great company, but far more bureaucratic, than anything I could imagine. And they just sort of drive me crazy. So I was there for a couple of years. Ted called me one time and he said, "Bob, what's the biggest difference between working for me and working for Coca-Cola?" And I said, "Well, Ted, working for you," he said, "we get together at lunch, and then we decide we're going to go do something, and then we go out that afternoon and we screw it up." I said, "At Coca-Cola, they have dozens of people work months and months, meetings and meetings and meetings, and then they screw it up." I said, I said, and he just kind of laughed. But after a couple of years, I thought I need to get into something that I can really enjoy. And I thought, well, if I went into the agency business, not really knowing exactly what it was. I could work for Coca-Cola and I could work for Turner. And Bob Cohn was trying to do an exit plan from Cohn and Wolf, and so he came in and we did a deal where I'd get 10% of his stock for over 10 years, and then he'd work for me during his retirement. And we started into that, but we grew really quickly and bought by Burson Marsteller in New York. And Burson was the largest PR firm in the world. And so I had this adventure of getting into the PR business and then fairly quickly ending up in New York. And again, New York is certainly the center of the communications world, and also the place where you hang around big names. I mean, it was up there. We had every CEO you could even imagine, whether Jack Welch, Warren Buffett, all of them had some association. And I had the office next to Harold Burson, who and Harold Burson in the PR business was considered like the father of the PR industry. So they all work with him. Well, since I was there with him, I got to, get involved in a lot of cool things, but also meet off a lot of cool people.
And can we talk about, I was lucky enough to know Bob and Harold. Can we talk a little about Bob Cohn?
Oh, absolutely. No, Bob was, we were two peas in a pod. I mean, I think I was a crazy promoter, and in some ways he was even crazier promoter, but we had no boundaries whatsoever in what we would do in order to get something done. And he was just a joy to work for. Bob, came up as a newspaper man, and then to make, basically to move on and make more money, he went into the agency business. And at the time I joined him, it was interesting. The PR agency business was very small in Atlanta. And even though we were probably the biggest firm, we only had like 8 or 9 people. So it was sort of a embryonic type situation where you go in. I always told him it was interesting that, the selling process of getting companies involved in hiring PR firms back then was you had to convince them they needed a PR firm. And then once they were convinced, you had to convince them you were the right one to be hired. So it was, and Bob was colorful. He was a great presenter. He was bigger than life, and it was just a joyful time to be around him. After Cohn & Wolf was bought by Burson Marsteller in New York, they came to me and asked me to move to New York, and that I don't I'm not and the thought process in that was I'm from the South. And Harold Burson was a sweet little man from Memphis, Tennessee, and he was stepping down as CEO of Burson Marsteller. Jim Dowling, who was his COO, was stepping up as CEO, but Jim Dowling had a more gruff personality, and they were looking for somebody that was as close to Harold as they could find to sort of buffer Jim. So I'm up there and was able to report to him. It was a great job to have. We had 800 PR people in the building, part of the. What they told me is get to know everybody in the building, which was fun for me. And then they had 78 offices around the world, and you get to go to all these cool places. And we were a division of Young and Rubicam, and Alex Kroll, the CEO of Young and Rubicam, was a former lineman for the New York Jets, and ominous figure, and seemed like a lot of people were sort of intimidated by him, but I'd worked for Ted Turner. It didn't bother me. So Alex and I got along really well. It was just a wonderful time, wonderful experience.
And Harold, also a very special guy.
Yeah, Harold was the counselor's counselor. I mean, he basically, I would be privy to going to dinners that he would have with CEOs or lunches or meetings. And I remember Roberto Gazzuetta, who was the legendary CEO of the Coca-Cola company, he and Harold would have dinner like once a month. And I'd tag along sometimes. And I remember Roberto Gazzuetta, told Harold one time, he said, "One of the things I appreciate the most about you is I never feel like you're trying to sell me anything. You're always trying to give me good advice, and good advice would then lead to programs." And I always thought that's probably the way the world should be. You don't want to be trying to put sell people something they don't really want. You just want to be there to help them when they need help.
And as you're rising up the corporate ranks, very different environment than what you had with the Braves, going back to those earlier stories, I would think a lot of that on the job in the frying pan training that you got really helped you in the corporate world.
No, there's no question about it. I mean, I think I'm adaptable. I mean, I had no problem. Bob Cohn used to get gruff with Burson Marsteller because they had all these procedures. Well, they bought Cohn and Wolf. So, I mean, you got to do their procedures. The procedures didn't really bother me. I figured, when you have a big organization like that, you're going to have a lot of, your finances in very rigorous, shape, and people are going to have to adhere to the way you operate. So, doing that, you just learn an awful lot. I mean, you learn basically how to manage what could be an unwieldy global organization that if you didn't have procedures in place that people adhered to. And also, in a creative business like that, I mean, one of the things Harold Burson would say was that you have two ways to look at running an organization. Either you have all the answers, or all the people who work for you have all the answers. And he said, and if you have all the answers, he said, it's going to be painful because, the funnel's always going to end on you, and it really doesn't give people a chance to, use their skills and leadership. And he also would say, if somebody wants to work in this organization and they're not doing well in the job we have them doing, it's not their fault. It's our fault. We need to find the job where they can thrive and succeed. And I always thought those two little lessons were magical lessons, particularly when it comes to a creative organization. If you don't let people use their creativity, you're not really going to be very, very successful.
Yeah, so well said. Little cup of coffee with a firm that made quite an impression over a relatively short period of time, but was really another guy ahead of his time, was Chris Whittle and Whittle Communications.
Yeah, I'd been in New York for many years, several years, and then but Susan, my wife, never particularly liked it. And plus, I went to New York like a kid going to Disney World. I just wanted to experience New York, and I had no intent of staying there the rest of my life. I just thought, well, I mean, it'll be a kick, and then I'll somehow get back home. But then when I got up there, I realized that the whole intent was for me to stay in New York. And so I was up there, and after I'd been there, I guess about 6 years, I was invited to be a speaker at the Magazine Publishers Association of America at the Scottsdale Princess Hotel at their annual convention. I'm not a member, so I'm just going down there, and Susan, and it was over our anniversary weekend, and I made a 20-minute speech, and the rest of the time we could just go do whatever. So one day we decided we'd drive down through the desert to Tucson and then to the Mexican border. Well, our Hertz rental car, driving through the desert, caught on fire. And so we're out there, and this is before cell phones, and there were no telephone wires, and trucks didn't want to stop. We were just sort of stuck. And Susan jumped out of the car and she said, "You have ruined my life." She said, "Here we are broken down in the desert, and you have me living in New York City." And I thought for a second, I said, "Well, if I told her I could get her out of the desert, she'd never believe me. But if I told her, give me a year and I'll get you back home to Atlanta." So, and I made that commitment. Well, I had to find a way to transition where she could live in Atlanta. And Knoxville was close enough that that I could, commute each week and go up there without any problem. And so I, took a job. Jerry Hogan, who is very close to me at Turner, and Jerry, became the vice chairman at Whittle, and he said, "Look, I'm not going there unless you go with me." So I went with him, and that was an interesting and great experience because my role was more the traditional Whittle that worked. And then Chris got into trouble because he stretched himself too far in things like Medical News Network and some things that just fell apart. Well, my part of the business was really pretty good. And so after a couple of years, they shut down, but they said, "Look, we don't want to screw you up, so you can take the business that you've generated here and take it with you." And that's when I hooked up with Paul Beckham, who I'd known forever. Paul was a financial guy that Ted sort of had tag along with me when I was with the Braves to make sure I didn't do anything crazy. And so Paul and I started Hope Beckham at the time and took what was what had been my part of Whittle Communications to start the business.
And you had a multi-year, decades-long, wonderful run with Paul, who, as you share, is no longer with us. But I have some great memories of spending time with the both of you well over 30 years ago. Talk about Hope Beckham, because you guys got an awful lot of wonderful stuff done over 30 years.
Oh yeah, no, we've done everything from we were in charge of the Olympics for Coca-Cola in both times when it was in the U.S. and which was a great experience for us. We've we've done crazy things like we built the world's largest peanut for the National Peanut Board and toured it around the country. We've had did a basketball tournament in the Middle East for countries in the Middle East were in conflict to bring together college basketball play. Teams to play and did that for years. Just had our Silver Bullets women's baseball team that was managed by Phil Decro toured around. So we did a lot of event related stuff, but we also have had serious clients, corporate clients. So we do Google now. We have Norfolk Southern. We have certainly have continued over the years to work for Coca-Cola and other big companies. So it's been an interesting mix of colorful and sort of glitzy, different, I guess, event related things to all just doing, traditional corporate communications.
And Bob, you have the benefit of perspective, having, been around the block a few times, still working actively in the business. Give us sort of a state of the union with what you see in the contemporary world. The digital world has, really taken hold, and so much of what dominates the conversation on stages today has to do with developments that have happened in technology the last 20 some odd years, from the iPhone to YouTube to, all the other social platforms. Give us your state of the union on where we are now.
Well, I think it's, we're sort of reliving a different version of what was the internet bubble that burst. Companies were thinking they were in the internet business and not thinking of the internet as a tool. And, and some people obviously used it as a tool. Amazon and others really were became very successful because they knew how to use the internet. But all of these internet startups, so many of them viewed themselves as internet companies. We're going through the same thing right now with technology and communication. So many agencies think, oh my gosh, we do, every form of digital you can do. We know how to, we build websites, we, do Facebook, we do, LinkedIn, we do, these are the ways you communicate. Well, the truth is those are tools. And I think what we do tend to forget sometimes is the real mission is to tell a story well. And if a story is told well, then those tools all, gravitate to you and become very useful. But you can put all the stuff out there you want to on social media, and if it's not a strong story, it's just not going to work. And I do think we're beginning to realize that we, we have to really be authors of very authentic stories and represent whatever the client is well. By telling their story well. And then, whatever tools we use will do the job.
And Bob, just to wrap, you've done so much, such an incredible career. What else is ahead that you haven't done that you want to get to?
Well, first of all, old age is when your regrets replace your dreams. And I have a lot of dreams. I'm very, very excited about what's happening in women's sports. God knows I was on the board of the Women's Sports Foundation with Billie Jean King's organization for years. I testified for Title IX before Congress. I'm very have two daughters and two granddaughters. And so what I'd like to do is find ways that I can facilitate continued growth in opportunities for girls and women in sports and in other areas, but sports is the one that I'm most familiar with. And then also just be engaged in interesting big projects. Like right now, I mean, some of these will sound are awkward considering the time, but right now we're are working with the Maccabiah Games in Israel to figure out how do they, they're supposed to be held next summer, in July. Well, how do you approach that? How do you communicate that? How do you get the support they need? Also working with the World Roller Derby League, which is interesting to me because sports teams. I guess I was in 2009. I was the NBA asked me to find an owner for the Atlanta Dream WNBA team. Well, the ownership cost back then was $2 million. That was a franchise cost, and I worked like crazy, and I finally found an owner for him. Well, now WNBA team's worth $150 million. So, just to be in the middle of all that, just see how things emerge, just is very interesting to me. And also the great thing about our business is when the phone rings, you never know who's going to call. I mean, just, it can change your entire journey in a very dramatic way just by somebody saying, "Hey, we know that you we think you can help us in this. What do you think?" And then you just jump in and it becomes very interesting.
Well, well said. And one of the reasons why I admire you so much is you've always been a how about this, how about that guy, and never worried about why something couldn't be done. You have always done with humor and humility. I'm so glad that we still got you around, Bob, and we got a chance to talk to you here today. This was an absolute joy.
Yeah, well, this is great. Now, this is, if you know, the longer you're around, the more you've seen and the more you feel like you can help people. Because I always tell people in our business, there's probably not a new problem you can come up with that I haven't seen before. So.
So well said. All right, buddy, we'll stay in touch.
Great. Talk to you later. Thanks a lot.
Bye.